You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cutts.
Friends, in the past, I've had an Aussie season. And more recently, what I just like to do for the gift, just this is my way of serving the world, I like to sprinkle the Aussies through the whole season. I heard your cries where you're like, we need more Aussies. Because let's be honest, folks, if I may be so humble to say it, the world just needs more Australians. Probably all of you listening to this, you know at least one Aussie. And what you yearn for more than anything else is to know one more. I've got a great one for you today. Benjamin Wendell, the author of Good Catastrophe. Benjamin, first of all, welcome to Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Thank you, Steve. And you're right. We need more Australians. Let's do it.
Well, especially now for my global audience, it's not too late to point out that we did win the Ashes. Do you have a word for us on that?
Correct. That's, you know, a cricket for those that are not familiar. It's cricket. It's like baseball, but it goes for 5 days and then we do five of those games.
That's right.
You know, so it's long. It's long, but it's an iconic sporting competition in Australia.
And even after 5 days, there might not be a winner. That's the most remarkable thing about it. Benjamin, you wrote this book. It just came out a few months ago, Good Catastrophe. It reminds me of a book that Paul Brand and Philip Yancey wrote in the 90s called The Gift of Pain, a title that may not immediately appeal. Just give us an overview. What is Good Catastrophe about? And then we're actually going to dive into some of that and also some of your other work.
Well, for sure, Steve, it comes out of my journey. You know, I've been a pastor for over 20 years. And I think when you've walked with people, not just through the summits, but through the valleys, it places something in you where you want to help people unlock the force of hope in life's hardest fights. That's what Good Catastrophe is. It's a blueprint for people to find their way out of pain. And let me just say this, we need to retrain ourselves on how to handle imperfections, both as leaders, as individuals, and to the people that we are inspiring and leading. And we can talk about this, but I think a crucial need for us as leaders that comes out of this book is how to build a new hope narrative for a new and complex world.
Yeah, especially, I mean, here we are in 2023 and a hope that is grounded in reality, but also looking toward a future. It just feels like our culture is in desperate need of it. Benjamin, you started this book, I think it was on the first page, right out of the gate. We are with you as your 7-year-old boy is brutally attacked by a dog. To where you weren't sure at the time whether he would make it. And what really, I mean, I'm a dad, what really took my breath away is at 7, him not being sure if he would make it. Just take us back to that. What happened? And then let's just dig in a bit on what was going on in you in that moment.
Yeah, well, it was an Australian journalist, Steve, that said that days of tragedy start as any ordinary day. And that day was like that. You know, crises don't send a calendar invite. They trespass into our lives unexpectedly. And when my wife came running into our home, cradling our 7-year-old son, saying there's been a dog attack, I didn't know what she was even talking about. Like, you know, oh, like on the news or, you know, call an ambulance. And then it takes a while for just your brain to catch up in that moment and go, oh my goodness, it's my son. And the Rottweiler, you know, ragdolled him on the ground, had him by the neck, had him by the face. And when he looked up at me and said, you know, Daddy, is this it? And I mean, they're the moments just fill you with dread and terror as a father. And I start the book by sharing that story because I want to start a conversation with people about when life really hits with unexpected pain, problems, obstacles that happened in my life. And thank God, I mean, that whole journey, I've seen the remarkable turn of hope that God brings into those scenarios. Miraculously, his face was spared. He has a large scar right around the jugular artery, and he's had to process trauma. It hasn't been without its complications, Steve. And here's the tension, because I can sit here and say to you, on one hand, it was traumatic for him. He has a scar that he has to carry with him through life. And simultaneously, we saw God's miraculous hope at work. Both of those together is what this book addresses.
Yeah. You also open up about your own brother's journey with cancer. And what it invokes in me, Benjamin, is I've had quite a bit of grief in my life, and it took me until late to realize that I don't process it well, especially as a leader. I stuff it for the sake of the cause or the kingdom or for others. I'm prone. I used to think I focused on others because I was such a selfless person fulfilling the law of Christ. I've learned more recently that I focus on others to avoid looking at what's going on in me. I would just love to hear from you. How do you attend to your own grief as a leader when you can't step off the leadership treadmill? You got to keep leading. What's some of the things you do to attend to your own grief?
You know, coincidentally, it was actually on a trip to your now home state, Colorado. I was driving through the Rockies, and I'm going through, you know, these incredible summits, but you're essentially going through a valley. And I had a moment of realization that my soul is in a valley. And, you know, some call that a midlife crisis. Certainly, Steve, I hit some kind of wall in my personal journey. I was church planting. I was maybe 10 years in, wrestling with a whole bunch of things. And I recognized that I had locked a lot of pain away. But you can take a gold coin and put it in a box and bury it, but it remains a gold coin. The same happens with our trauma, with our anxiety, with the shadows of life. And I remember looking through that winding valley thinking, I can't stop here. I need to get through the valley, but the valley brings a gift. And I need to go on a process and on a journey. And I have been on a process and a journey. I mean, through that, yes, in the last year, my older brother, just 18 months older than me, we were almost raised as twins. You know, 80s was a great time to just be a kid in a suburban Australia, riding BMX bikes and just, man, we lived free. Come home when it goes dark. That was about it. My brother and I, we competed over everything, including who could eat the most cereal in the morning. And my family is a family of faith. My parents are pastors. I love my parents. They're incredibly resilient people. We all prayed. We all did our best to have whatever faith we're meant to have as followers of Jesus, as flawed as what that faith is. And we prayed, and he went through, you know, crazy treatment, and he died. And I include that story because, you know, he has a wife and young children, that if hope only exists when we get the endings we want, I don't think that fits the shape of our lived human experience or the world that we're in. And so I wanted to retreat the subject of hope and present a version of hope that works, that's gritty. It works its best when you don't get the endings that you want. And as a leader, it helps you develop a narrative that makes sense for a very complex world.
I think this is what I really appreciate about Good Catastrophe, Benjamin, and you, is I'm thinking of when Isaiah says he was acquainted with grief. It's such an understated phrase that this person's acquainted with grief. And I think in some ways as a leader, I'm always looking for leaders who are acquainted with grief because I know there's no other way to be refined, or I know that the grief and pain and suffering, it stops pretense, it makes you resist pithy statements. You mentioned in the book different pandemics. I feel like in some ways we've talked about the viral pandemic plenty. You reference economic pandemic, but you also talk about a grief pandemic. I'd love to hear what you mean by that.
Well, I think many people are experiencing a grief pandemic, especially in terms of how we process just the complexity of modern life. I mean, for example, any of us can lead when the sun is shining on a good day. But when crises hit, and just think of the world we're in right now. I mean, is AI going to take our job? Maybe in 2 years, Steve, it won't be you hosting the podcast. It'll be a robotic version of you, right? Cultural upheaval. I'm just showing you there are some dark clouds that are sitting on our culture. Political
division.
I do have
to interrupt and just, yeah. I mean, it's worth the question. Are you sure I'm me now?
I'm not sure, but if it is an avatar, it looks good, Steve. You look fantastic. Are you kidding me?
The facial creams I've been using, I feel.
it's working.
Yeah.
But start stacking it up, right? Political division, international conflict, racial tension, financial stress. I think we get why younger generations don't necessarily wake up each morning with optimism surging through their veins. And yet, here's the key. History shows us, scripture shows us, that the moments of dynamic human progress and innovation typically happen in the midst of chaos and challenge. And that's why the story that we tell about hope and resilience, it needs to look different. And we need a new set of markers to help us chart a course for today's culture and for new generation to thrive in what are challenging times.
I would like to take this opportunity just to get your advice, Benjamin, because I think a lot of our listeners are always looking for how do I be helpful to somebody in the early stages of their loss or their grief? And let's talk about maybe grief as it relates to a family member dying, or it could be a loss of a job. But in that initial shock, and oftentimes a Christian leader is then coming over to their house. What's your advice? What's your training for that Christian leader on how they can actually be helpful in another person's grief?
Okay, let me frame the answer this way. What amplifies and accentuates the deep challenge of grief is loneliness. And it's just amazing, Steve, how many people feel uncomfortable stepping into your grief, so they just stay away. Now, I see kind of an archetype in Job's three infamous friends, right? Now, these three guys did step into his loneliness, but then they said some things that maybe were secondary trauma, right? They gave some poor advice when maybe they should have just listened. But when you read the story closely, I think there's a lesson in it for all of us that are leaders and stepping into people's grief. And it's this. These three friends left their homes, families, cities, and traveled to spend time with Job. And I think it's perhaps the most beautiful moment in the whole story of Job. More than the ending, more than the redemption that comes. On the horizon, I mean, Job is in the dust, right? Dried tears on his face, and he sees the outline of three men. And hope walks into his life in the form of three friends. They're not going on a vacation. They're not going to the beach. They're there to be friends. And I think that there is a link between hope in the midst of grief and friendship. In fact, I'm not sure the words hope and alone are compatible. So to me, it's a twofold lesson, Steve, which is we need to show up physically. A text is not showing up. A phone call is not showing up. A letter is not showing up when we can physically step into somebody's life, which means, now we can't do this for everybody, but if we're talking about people that are close to us and in our world, it's getting in the car, it's sitting with people. But here's the hidden part about these three friends. They actually didn't talk for the first 7 days. And that's easily overlooked. They simply sat with him as friends.
They did a better job than I would have done. I mean, that
correct.
I'm totally with you that they ended up giving what could be probably, I think the church word for it is stupid advice. But
yes.
But man, 7 days in silence, I think I'm good for about 14 minutes.
That's right. So I put it this way. Hope needs human skin. The more physically present that we can be, we don't need the right words, but there is a beauty when somebody is willing to step into your grief and sit with you in your grief. And I say to my sons, a problem shared is a problem halved. And I think grief shared, it may not be halved, but it is medicated by the presence of people that turn up and show up in your midnight hour, and it's amplified in isolation and in loneliness.
Let me just scratch on this a little bit more before we kind of move through our themes today, Benjamin. My experience of grief, sometimes it really helps me to tell a story about a loved one. Sometimes I just want to live my life and not talk about it at all. Stop, please don't ask me about it. I just need, and I think it can be tricky when we are with somebody who is in active and early grief to be so attentive to them that we can be aware of when they want to share stories and when they just want to talk about the TV show or something mundane. I know for me, it's the energy of managing my own need to make them feel better. Do you have any cues or tips for people on how to read somebody and enter into their space so they're not alone? But I just want to take this deeper because I think this is such an important thing, and I certainly was not taught this in any leadership or pastoral work. What's your take on how to really attend to someone like that?
I think, you know, if I speak out of my own journey, sometimes as leaders, we feel like we need to have the answers. What can be even more helpful and powerful is having questions. And I don't think there's anything wrong or awkward or weird about literally asking people,
okay,
how can I best show up for you in this moment? Would you like to talk about such and such? Would you like to discuss? Would you prefer for me to simply physically be here and not say a word? I think we can ask. Now, sure, in early trauma, maybe you can't ask anything and you're just physically present. But in my generation, millennials, one out of every four of us say this: we don't have a single friend to call in the world when we go through a time of need. I mean, it means a quarter of us truly feel alone on an island. And so that's where I'm saying, hey, when we can even just turn up for people and take the lead from them and be sensitive and nuanced and ask questions and not feel like we've got to give our favorite verse, not feel like we've got to give the five lessons that we learned, not feel like we've got to give the phrase that rhymes, you know, it's okay to simply sit, listen, ask questions, and follow the lead of the person who's going through a valley or going through a storm.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, thanks for that. A lot of your work, Benjamin, you've got some interesting dynamics here. You do generational work. You help older generations understand younger generations. A lot of your focus is really ensuring that millennials and Gen Zs are interested in church and faith. And that does raise for me the topic of resilience, because I think older generations misunderstand millennials and Gen Zs, and they make the assumption that those younger generations are less resilient than us. I don't agree with that. What's your take?
Well, I think how we process pain and challenge today is just more complex. I see that with my own kids, with phones and the internet. It's very difficult to compare generations, but I will say this. If you're a leader, if you're a part of an older generation, I think we are responsible for the framework that we hand down to younger generations. And the contemporary way of discussing hope and resilience is almost this idea that you can live a trouble-free life, exempt from hardship. I mean, I've been around church my entire life. And in my era of being raised, we were good at talking about favor and goodness and breakthrough. And the narrative can start to sound like, unintentionally, put your faith in God, put God first, and your life will be blessed in a way that looks like a postcard perfect life. And then mud gets thrown at the canvas and we get hit with a storm, a loss, imperfections. So we need to teach younger generations that hardship and hope together can do something for us that a problem-free life never could. We have to understand younger generations are inheriting a rate of change that is faster than any other point in human history. They are handling an information overload and constant stream that, again, is different than any other point in history. So we need to transport the lessons of older generations, like our grandparents, and we need to pass them down the line as a precious gift to younger generations. And I think it probably is a deficiency in younger generations. And it's a gift that we have to pass on as leaders to young people to help them reframe how they see problems and, again, retrain themselves on how to process imperfections.
So you raise a fascinating point. My great uncle, Uncle Orb, was one of the originals on Gallipoli, which is obviously an Aussie reference. Yeah. World War One, probably Australia's most famous battle. Thanks, Winston Churchill, by the way. But anyway, this is really the war and the battle that defined Aussie culture. Every Aussie of our generation can talk about Gallipoli. So my uncle was one of the first on the beach, my great uncle, excuse me. And probably the most defining description of him is silence. When we would go over to his house, he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't tell us those stories. He was a war hero in our family. He would not talk about it. And I use that as one extreme. And then I look at my daughter and her friends, and troubles and anxiety is all they talk about. I mean, it's so much. They're much more fluent in the language of challenge and anxiety. On my great uncle's spectrum, it would take a great deal of challenge for him to say that was hard. On my daughter's spectrum, it takes no challenge at all to say that was hard. When you hear that, Benjamin, what do you make of all of that?
I think it's a fascinating observation that you make, and very true, because I also have relatives in my own family that I see that. I literally tell my kids about the silent generation as a cautionary tale and tell them in that one regard, don't lock your emotions away, process them out loud, talk about things. Because if you seal them up, they grow and they multiply. In the dark, you have to let the light in. I think that there are takeaways from all generations. One of the takeaways that we do have from the silent generation is look at what they built, look at what they constructed, look at what they proactively went out and achieved and did in spite of fear. They didn't have the vocabulary to navigate through imperfections and trauma the way that we do. But at the same time, we can't be so obsessed with telling our own self story over and over again, that we give so much room and credit to pain and problems that then they just overwhelm us and we catastrophize and these things, you know, become major issues. And so that's why, to me, the idea of modern resilience is so crucial. So I trace the etymology of this word, resilience, back to the history of mechanical watchmaking. In the 19th century, the word resilient was a technical term that watchmakers used to describe the ability of a watch to absorb shock. Now, if you think about a mechanical watch, the watch goes with the wearer wherever the wearer goes. So it can be bumped against a tree, during a hike in a dense forest pounded by waves as you dive into the ocean. It can be jolted as the wearer swings a hammer in construction. The point is this: any jarring shock sends vibrations through the internal components. A watch that lacks resilience is thrown out of time by the bumps and the knocks. And it's the same with people. The ability to keep time, the ability to stay true to who we are and absorb circumstances, storms, is a critical skill to learn in life. If younger generations' version of happiness is reliant on them removing all of the problems and imperfections out of their life, they're going to lack the ability to stand up to the rigors of disappointments, failures, and loss. So when our life gets knocked, Steve, sometimes the greatest play that we have available to us is to be able to absorb the impact and bounce back. And I do think that that's a lesson for younger generations to say, you're going to get knocked and hit and storms and challenges, and that's normal. That's not lack of faith. That's not something wrong with you. But equally so, there's this crucial lesson of the ability to bounce back that I think we can look back in time at previous generations and say they did that remarkably well.
Okay, so let's say someone's listening to what you just said and they're thinking to themselves, that sounds amazing. Like as you told us in your own life, you can't decide when trouble's going to hit. It just hits. What are two or three habits that somebody can cultivate now to build their resilience for when the storm comes?
Well, you know, Steve, I can say things as simple as like, you know, the victory today may be simply getting out of bed in the morning or walking the dog or showing up for work or smiling at your spouse. We have to debunk this idea that you have to be absolutely soaring every moment of every year and just dominating in every area of life, right? So I think giving ourselves space to be human is important, but we have to not avoid pain, suppress it, fear it, but retrain ourselves to use it and tell ourselves, this adversity will grow me, it will deepen me, it will make me. There are two practical things I would say. Number one, we need to debunk outcome-based hope. Don't link your optimism towards thinking that you're going to get a specific set of circumstances, which may or may not happen. Okay, we need to decouple hope from the outcome. And if you're a follower of Jesus, weld your hope, not to what may or may not change circumstantially in your life, but to the person and the promise of Jesus. And secondly, we need to see the link between challenges and growth. The clearer we see that link, we start to fundamentally approach our challenges differently, because it's like, oh, okay, this isn't going to crush me. I mean, you know, you'll know this, Steve, from Australia. The eucalyptus trees, which carpet a lot of the Australian landscape, there's certain species. I had a fire in my land and I discovered this. There are certain species that the seeds only germinate through forest fires. It burns away the tough outer coating. So it's not just that the seed survives the fire. It's more beautiful than that, more dramatic than in that. The seed requires the fire to fulfill its full potential. And when we can understand the fire I'm walking through, yes, it burns. Yes, it's destructive. But simultaneously, it is unlocking parts of my potential, my genetic code, my full expression of who I am that I will not get any other way. I won't get it lying by a pool in a resort. I won't get it at a buffet at a cruise ship. It changes the way we approach every imperfection in our life.
Benjamin, you've been very kind to come on the show. And boy, you've just given us some, I think, so many metaphors and nuggets where we can really be provoked to think about not inviting catastrophe, but certainly stewarding it when it comes our way. You know, I guess I think there's only two types of leaders, those who are fighting some battle and those who will one day. I don't know any other way. However, I am aware that we have not yet inflicted upon you the gauntlet of anxiety questions. And so everything that you've said so far in the interview may be undone by what's about to happen. If you'd like to brace yourself like a man.
I'm looking forward to it.
Question number one, just give us a sort of leadership situation that is guaranteed to generate leadership anxiety in your life.
Leadership anxiety for me would look like, you know, maybe conflict with those that are closest to my inner circle and having to navigate the dual relationships that come with that. I kind of feel like often in my leadership, I can deal with big challenges out there. Relational complexity close to home. Yeah, that will do it for me.
Okay, very good. Jeannie Duck famously says, in the absence of information, we connect the dots in the most pathological way possible. When you don't have enough information, you don't know, and you're leaping to assumptions, what are some of the things that your brain is telling you, or what are some of the things going around in your head?
My brain is telling me the worst case scenario, chronic overthinker. My brain is telling me to fear and worry and stress. And I don't have to wake up in the morning, Steve, and go, hey, let me read that list of like 12 ways to think negatively or to worry. That comes pretty naturally to me. So I've got to be super intentional about being optimistic and not rehearsing worst case scenarios and trying to move myself to a position of faith and, well, what's the best case scenario? But none of those things are my default.
One of the things that we teach is that we all bring our family of origin everywhere we go, whether we want to or not. What would be one asset and one liability that you've inherited from your family of origin?
Well, you know, there's a lot of assets. When I look at my parents, my wife's parents, they're incredibly consistent, faithful people. And it's an amazing model for me to look at that in my family, just the consistency of faith, the consistency of family and marriage. So I take that with me. On my side, my heritage, yes, I'm Australian, but it's Greek. So I think, you know, with the Greek, with the family side there can come passion, can come unbridled emotion, and that can get the better of you sometimes. So I carry that with me as well.
I must say, I'm impressed as a Greek man or with a Greek heritage that you still refer to yourself as an Aussie. I have Australian Greek friends who fundamentally refer to themselves as Greek. Okay, one of our newer tools that we're working on the podcast this season, Benjamin, and I'll word it a little bit. I'm still, to be honest, still trying to figure out how to word it cleanly. I treat my friends and people I love better than I treat myself. The way I talk to myself, like I call myself stupid quite often, for example, but also in the fact that I check in with my friends and I don't typically check in with myself. So that's kind of the context of the question. Here's the question. If you treated yourself as well as you treated others, what is one way of dealing with yourself that might change for you?
Geez, it's a great question, Steve. I think you're right. We are more gracious often and attentive to those in our world than what we are ourselves. I think in this season of life, one of the things that I'm learning in terms of just my own journey, because I've pastored for, you know, the majority of my adult life, and that's a great example of you're focused on the needs of others. I think I can make the best difference in my lifetime and the maximum contribution when I'm healthy, when I'm thriving, and not apologizing for that, not feeling guilty for that. and structuring my life in a way that brings me joy. Not just like, well, I'm like a, you know, hard done by missionary kind of mindset of, if it's terrible and I hate it, that's probably because God wants me to do it. So I should just suffer in this. I've changed my perspective on that. Unless you literally are a missionary in a third world country, I have fundamentally changed my perspective on that to say, what brings me joy and brings replenishing life to me? Do more of that.
Wonderful. Okay, the final question. I'm almost disappointed at how comfortably you've sailed through the gauntlet, but the final question, could you give us a time in the last few weeks where you've just felt fully free? And what were you doing or who were you around? What was happening when you felt fully free?
Well, the answer may be a little bit just too normal and practical for you, but my kids finally went back to school yesterday. Okay. Are you kidding me? It's been a long summer. So we drove in a minivan from Los Angeles to Nashville, Tennessee, with three kids and a dog. My kids are back at school, and there was a moment when they got dropped off where my wife and I, we held hands, and we're like, it's just us. It's just us. There's some freedom.
That's a beautiful answer. My guest is Benjamin Wendell. His book, or his most recent book, is Good Catastrophe. Benjamin, as you've heard on this show, is bringing such a down-to-earth approach for all of us to build our resilience and to have a hope that is forged on something solid. I think his work is so essential for us. Here we are, you know, three-ish years post-COVID, still with lingering after effects. And what I've most encountered with Benjamin's work is his teaching gift, his ability to really help us see what he's saying. I have so many people who talk about grief and hope and resilience. They get very conceptual. I've appreciated, Benjamin, how practical. You've given us something to do. You've given us things to really hang our hat on. So thank you so much for coming on Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a real joy.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.